This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Askar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa huwal hayyul qayyum. La ta'khudhuhu sinatun wa la nawm. Lahu ma fis samawati wa ma من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات والأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه يعلم ما بين أيديهم وما خلفهم ولا يحيطون بشيء من علمه إلا بما شاء وسع كرسيه السماوات ولا يؤوده حفظهما وهو العلي العظيم وذق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not. and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Love movement denounces new U.S. sanctions against the group, saying they are an extension to a systematic plan to destroy the Yemeni economy. Venezuela says it has failed to complete a payment for a global program to buy coronavirus vaccines amid U.S. sanctions on the Latin American state. Also ahead, the EU foreign policy chief says the Vienna talks on the revival of the Iran nuclear deal are intense and slow, and there's still a lot of work to be done. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, the Sour Yemen's Ansar Allah movement has denounced new U.S. sanctions against the group as a new crime against the Yemeni nation. A member of the Supreme Political Council of Yemen said the United States is putting the war option as its first priority while pretending to seek peace. Mohammed Ali al-Houthi said imposing sanctions to bring peace will lead to nowhere. He stressed that the new measures are an extension to a systematic plan aimed at destroying Yemen's economy. The U.S. announced its new sanctions against Ansar Allah on Thursday. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the U.S. will continue to exert pressure on Ansar Allah to make it end their offensive in Ma'rib. Ansar Allah and its allied army units are engaged in a battle to liberate the city from Saudi-backed forces. Political commentator Hossein al-Bukhaiti says the U.S. imposes sanctions on Ansar Allah because the movement threatens Washington's policies in the region.
The United States is using the blockade as well as the weapons, and for them to put more sanction on Ansar Allah, I don't think this actually will make any difference on Yemeni army advance toward Ma'rib or any coming attack against Saudi Arabia. But as Muhammad Ali al-Houthi said, that is, to force sanction on one side to seek peace, this actually will get you nowhere, because we remember that when Trump administration in the final days, they have put the entire movement, Ansar Allah movement, as a terrorist group. This actually has not changed anything. This sanction actually is because Ansar Allah is against U.S. Foreign policy, and because it shows that Ansar Allah is the only group in Yemen that's actually threatened the U.S. and the Zionist and the Saudi policy in the region. Right. And this actually is a kind of honor for them to be sanctioned by the United States.
Venezuela says it has been unable to complete payments for COVAX, the global COVID-19 vaccine program, because the payments were blocked.
Venezuela paid the full installment required by COVAX, but the last four payments amounting to $10 were blocked, and this is how COVAX informs us, where it says, in relation to the four payments mentioned, I confirm that we have received a notification from UBS Bank that the payments have been blocked and are under investigation.
Venezuela's vice president has blamed the U.S. She said the U.S.-backed financial system has the power to block resources that can be used to immunize immunize the Venezuelan nation, the country is now denied access to 11 million doses of COVID vaccines. Caracas secured them in March after months of diplomatic efforts. Venezuela has also used Russian and Chinese jabs to make up for vaccine shortages caused by financial restrictions put by the U.S. The Latin American country has reported more than 246,700 COVID cases with nearly 2,800 deaths. Barry Grossman is an international lawyer and joins us now out of Bali. Barry, you know, for months this man, President Biden, was slamming, during his presidential campaign, was slamming Trump for the American death toll and saying that it was under Trump's watch that Americans were dying from COVID. And now we're seeing under Biden's watch, Venezuelans are dying from COVID-19 because of their lack. They can't access vaccines because of U.S. sanctions. So many will be asking here, is American blood more precious than Venezuelan blood?
Well, I mean, you know, to break that down, clearly whenever politicians speak in the United States, no matter how much it might seem from what you're saying, that they're genuinely criticizing the opposition, it really always just comes down to partisan rivalry. We certainly saw that with the Democrat-controlled congressional inquiry into torture during the Bush administration, which, despite the findings, went nowhere. Now, when it comes to COVID-19, we see much the same thing. What I will say about this move is that it should leave no doubt in anyone's mind that the U.S. handling of this crisis is not even remotely concerned with global public health so much as clearing the way for brands controlled by the United States to get the lion's market share of vaccines around the world. And there's nothing standing in the way of the political apparatus's ability to use its power to go after other nations which haven't fully embraced the U.S. Position as global leader and global superpower by denying them access to all manner of things, including vaccines, which are essential, they argue, to the health and well-being of the people. Anyone who thinks that U.S. sanctions are intended to inconvenience and target the political leadership really needs to think again, because we've seen time and time again that the United States doesn't bat an eye at taking the fight directly to the people of the nation using tactics which very often cost many, many, many thousands of lives. And we're seeing it again with this. On the one hand, the U.S. claims to be the global leader in fighting this unusual pandemic. And on the other hand, we see them insisting on making sure that everyone pays top dollar for their vaccines. They refuse pretty much to recognize any vaccines that don't originate from them or one of their European allies. And they're quite intent on blocking access to vaccines on the part of people in countries which the U.S. maintains a comprehensive program of sanctions against. All of which is clearly outrageous, and their hands are, as you point out, drenched in blood one more time.
Barry, thank you very much indeed for your contribution and your thoughts. Barry Grossman, the international lawyer, joining us out of Bali. Now, moving on, India has reported more than 91,700 new COVID cases in the past 24 hours. The figure brings India's total case tally to more than 29 million. Its COVID deaths passed 363,000 after more than 3,400 new deaths were posted in the past 24 hours. India was struggling with a devastating second wave of coronavirus in April and May that caused daily infections to reach their peak of more than 400,000 last month. Strict lockdowns and vaccinations helped contain the surge. Now, daily new cases have remained below 100,000 over the past several days.
The COVID-19 pandemic has hampered India's ambition of double-digit growth by 2022. In its latest report, the World Bank has slashed the country's growth forecast to 8.3% from 10.1% estimated earlier. The service sector is the hardest hit, the report added, stressing on higher spending on infrastructure, rural development and healthcare. The ongoing economic turmoil sparked by COVID pandemic has dragged millions in poverty and unemployment.
The damage was already done with the COVID first wave, but whatever was left, second wave devastated it further. It is very hard to find work these days because there is less activity in construction sector.
In recent weeks, the government announced a set of policies related to spending after a pandemic deteriorated the economic prospectus. The central bank also announced measures for micro, small and medium businesses. Over the last few months, India has been struggling with a ferocious second wave of the COVID-19 pandemic with around 400,000 daily cases and thousands of deaths. Hospitals were reeling under shortage of space, oxygen, beds and vaccines. This prompted the government to announce more stringent lockdowns, which resulted in huge economic costs for the world's second most populous nation, where millions rely on daily wages. Migrant workers were the hardest hit.
No matter what it is, the poor people are the ones who struggle most. Rich people have savings, they can survive. But what about us? The second wave has finished everything we had. If these lockdowns continue, we will die.
The government of Prime Minister Modi has faced criticism over handling COVID crisis. The pandemic with economic slowdown has devastated the livelihood of millions in India. The country is also staring at unemployment crisis, with youth being the worst affected. Observers say to counter slowing economy and unemployment crisis, India needs to launch more stimulus packages and job support schemes the way other developed nations did after COVID ravaged their economies. But fear of third wave in India is creating further doubts if the country is ready to deal with another looming situation. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Turning to other news now, the European Union's foreign policy chief says talks to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal are intense and slow. Josep Borrell said the EU is working on what he calls a non-stop basis to revive the accord in all its aspects. His comments came as the remaining signatories to the international agreement are set to meet in the Austrian capital, Vienna, on Saturday for the sixth round of talks. According to the diplomats participating in the talks, disagreements persist about a few key issues. The negotiations are being held on a possible U.S. return to the deal, also known as the JCPOA, and the complete removal of sanctions against Iran. Author and journalist Daniel Lazar says the U.S. is reluctant to come back to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and remove anti-Tehran sanctions.
Well, I've always been very pessimistic about the prospect of the U.S. re-entering the JCPOA. The U.S., the Congress is dominated by anti-Iran hardliners, and the administration is on tacking on extra to the JCPOA, and it's extremely reluctant to remove anti-Iran sanctions. So for that reason, I think I doubt the talks will go anywhere very soon. They really don't want an agreement. They want to push for the economic strangulation of Iran, a rollback of Iranian power, and a further tipping of the balance of power in the Middle East towards Saudi Arabia and especially towards Israel. The U.S. has been firm on this issue. It was firm under the Trump administration, and now with the stance is equally hard on Biden administration.
The Palestinian prime minister has slammed as state terrorism Israel's killing of three Palestinians in the West Bank city of Jenin. In a press statement, Mohammed Shetaya said the assassination was an attempt by a battled Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to save his political career and stay in office for longer. The Palestinian premier urged the international community to call for an end to assassinations, racism and ethnic cleansing being committed by the Israeli regime.
Israeli forces have shot dead some Palestinians in a pre-dawn raid in the city of Jenin, northern the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces raided Jenin to carry out an arrest operation, according to the Israeli military. Outside the headquarters of the Palestinian Authority's military intelligence, a shootout erupted between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian security forces. During the operation, Israeli forces killed Jamil Al-Amouri, a member of the Jihad movement and a former prisoner, and also arrested another operative whom Israel claims it was looking for both.
What happened in Jenin is a new crime. Israel has got crazy after facing resistance by the Palestinians in Al-Quds, the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Now it's seeking to show its strength by more killings. It thinks that these killings would prevent the Palestinians from continuing their struggle, but the Palestinians have shown that they won't give in to pressure.
Palestinian factions from across the political spectrum called a general strike in the city to mark the deaths of those killed. Thousands of mourners turned out on the streets in Jenin City to take part in the funeral's procession of the security officers. A third funeral has not been held, as the Israeli forces had arrested the third man before he succumbed to his injuries.
There are orders from the Israeli authorities to accelerate the situation. Netanyahu doesn't want to leave office. He doesn't want to be imprisoned. That's why he wants to make an escalation. But Israel must know that it would pay a high price for its crimes.
The Palestinian presidency has meanwhile condemned the Israeli operation in Jenin, with spokesman Nabil Aburdena holding the Israeli regime responsible for this escalation and its consequences.
Israeli forces have not yet handed over the body of the third Palestinian killed during Jenin raid, Jamil Al-Amouri, a former prisoner and member of the Jihad movement. And now Tel Aviv withholds the bodies of 79 Palestinians in its mortuaries, claiming they were killed for operations against Israeli forces. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Now, the French President Emmanuel Macron has announced a drawdown of France's military operations against militants in the Sahel region of Africa.
The desired result is obviously to reduce our multiple hooks, to reduce the logic of external operations, to keep two pillars. One pillar, the fight against terrorism with the special forces structured around Takuba, obviously with a strong French component, with several hundred soldiers and African, European and international forces at our side, but with a vocation to carry out strictly counter-terrorism interventions and with far fewer hooks.
Macron said France's operations in West Africa would come to an end and be merged into a broader international mission. France currently has 5,100 troops in the Sahel region that encompasses several African countries, including Mali. The presence of French forces in the Sahel is rejected by some politicians and locals as a colonial throwback. In January, Malians protested in the capital against France's military presence in their country. Thousands of soldiers and civilians have died in the Sahel conflict over the past years. More than 2 million people have also been displaced. Brings it end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Progressive New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has criticized Vice President Kamala Harris for saying undocumented migrants from Guatemala should not come to the United States. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Gloria Oladipo. The piece is titled, AOC Condemns Kamala Harris for Telling Guatemalan Migrants Not to Come to U.S. First foreign trip as Vice President, Kamala Harris visited Guatemala on Monday. At a press conference with Guatemala's President, Alejandro Yamatei, the former California senator spoke about investigating corruption and human trafficking in Central America and described a future where Guatemalans could find hope at home. But she also had a clear message that undocumented Guatemalan migrants would not find solace at the U.S. border under the Biden administration. I want to be clear to folks in the region who are thinking about making that dangerous trek to the United States-Mexico border, she said. Do not come. Do not come. Later on Monday, Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez criticized Kamala Harris on Twitter, calling her comments disappointing to see. First, seeking asylum at any U.S. border is a 100% legal method of arrival, said the congresswoman, an influential voice on the Democratic left since her upset win in the 2018 primary and widely known as AOC. Second, the U.S. spent decades contributing to regime change and destabilization in Latin America. We can't help set someone's house on fire and then blame them for fleeing. Several human rights groups also spoke out. Rachel Schmidtke, a Latin America advocate at the nonprofit Refugee International, said, "We continue to urge the Biden administration to build policies that recognize that many Guatemalans will need to seek protection until the long-standing drivers of forced displacement are addressed and realign its message to the Guatemalan people to reflect America's commitment to the right to seek protection internationally." The Asylum Seeker Advocacy Project, a non-profit organization that works with asylum seekers, tweeted, "Kamala Harris seeking asylum is legal. Turning back asylum seekers is illegal, dangerous, and oftentimes sends them back to their deaths. Seeking asylum is a right under U.S. and international law." Vice President Kamala Harris, who visited Mexico on Tuesday, 8th of June, also faced questions about her choice not to visit the U.S.-Mexico border as part of a trip, saying that her focus was on addressing the root causes that prompt migrants to flee their homes. "I'm in Guatemala because my focus is dealing with the root causes of migration," Kamala Harris told NBC's Lester Holt. There may be some who think that that is not important, but it is my firm belief that if we care about what's happening at the border, we better care about the root causes and address them. During the NBC interview with Lester Holt, she dismissed the question on why she hadn't yet visited the border as vice president by responding, "And I haven't been to Europe, and I mean, I don't understand the point that you're making. I'm not discounting the importance of the border." Speaking to reporters in Mexico City, Kamala Harris also pledged she would eventually visit the border. Despite President Joe Biden moving to undo Trump-era restrictions at the border, including instituting changes to the asylum process, Kamala Harris's speech on Monday underlined the continued stance of turning back undocumented migrants. Central America has long been affected by poverty and violence, amid entrenched cycles of political instability, partly caused by criminal elites. Experts contend that the United States has often aided oppressive regimes. Despite the litany of dangers migrants often face when traveling north, the journey is often safer than remaining at home. People are leaving because the corrupt governments supported by the United States have tolerated and encouraged the growth of these criminal organizations, said Jeff Fu, the founder of the Economic Policy Institute, in an interview with USA Today. In April, according to CNN, more than 178,000 migrants arrived at the U.S.-Mexico border, the highest one-month total in two decades.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepest me alive. and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Midstream.
The Palestinian resistance is threatening to retaliate against Israeli provocations after a Qatari grant intended for families in need in the Gaza Strip was halted by the Zionist occupation. Hamas leaders have reportedly warned Egyptian mediators that they would take an important decision regarding the mutual ceasefire in the event Israel continues such unnecessary aggravations by the end of this week. The Palestinian warning came in the wake of the Qataris informing the United Nations and officials in the Biden administration that such a step provokes the Palestinians and pushes towards an explosive situation. The Palestinian message precedes the Egyptians sending invitations to 19 resistance factions to attend high-level meetings in Cairo in the presence of President Mahmoud Abbas to open dialogue between the Palestinian Authority and the resistance factions in Gaza. For the first time, Cairo invites many resistance factions other than Hamas and the Islamic Jihad to attend the dialogues at the request of Hamas, given that all the factions were equal partners in the last battle despite objections from certain members of the Fatah movement. Meanwhile, Palestinian resistance factions stressed in a joint statement the need to stop all provocations practiced by the occupation in occupied Al-Quds and the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, to stop the aggression against the Palestinian people, to speed up reconstruction, and to lift the siege on Gaza. In the meantime, commander of the southern region in the Israeli occupation forces, Eliezer Toledano, announced that the army was preparing to resume fighting with Hamas again, because apparently what Israel did in the last round of terrorism against Gaza was not enough, adding that the next operation will not end without changing the security reality in Gaza. Adding salt to the injury, right-wing Zionist Jewish groups announced last week that they would redo the flag march they usually did on what they call Jerusalem Day next Thursday, after their provocative march this year was canceled due to heightened tensions. The march is expected to begin at 7 p.m. Al-Quds time on Thursday, June 10, and head through multiple routes towards the Western Wall near the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Israeli occupation forces have reportedly approved the march. However, Palestinian natives have warned that this provocation will only lead to renewed clashes. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. As Palestinian factions prepare for dialogue in Cairo, the invasive scene in Gaza is becoming more complex, foretelling the possibility of another confrontation again in light of Israel's insistence on pushing the Gaza Strip. While all border crossings have been closed since the last aggression, Israel's obstruction of the Qatari fund into Gaza poured fuel on the fire, calling for a strongly worded message from the resistance, in which it affirmed that unless the funds are released by this week, it will be concerned with taking an important decision regarding the cessation of hostilities. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Julia Qasim, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Julia. Now, the resistance factions have informed the Egyptian and the international mediators that the continuous Israeli provocations toward Gaza and its besieged citizens who are to benefit from the Qatari fund or the grant, which Israel is blocking, which more than 100,000 Palestinian families will be benefiting from, it will directly mean a push towards an escalation of the situation in Gaza. Do you think that Gaza can handle another round of the Israeli terrorism and violence?
Better question is, can the Zionist entity handle another round of Gazan resistance? And the answer is, it knows that it can't. The ceasefire that was called for was a one-sided ceasefire, with the Zionist entity basically begging for it, especially after basically receiving news that not only was the Zionist entity brought to its knees when the Gazan resistance barely even exhausted their old stockpiles, but the whole resistance axis was prepared to also come in on the condition that Gaza would, of course, invite them. But Israel was just definitely not ready to face like another round of rockets, including 300 rockets total fired at once, 150 alone at Tel Aviv. So it was terrified then. It's still terrified now. It's trying to even put pressure to make sure that the resistance doesn't respond to its provocations. And its provocations that we've seen in the last few weeks, including the attacks on Al-Aqsa, the harassment of Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan. It's trying to kind of push the envelope as far as to make itself look scary, but immediately stops once it realizes that the repercussions in another round of fighting could lead to its demise, most certainly. They released Muhammad and Muna al-Kurd within hours of detaining them, and this is out of fear. 2 days ago, the Zionist entity canceled the military parade, and today they were too afraid to even wave their occupier flags in Jerusalem. So I would say that it is actually Israel that is put on the defensive this time.
Well, Julia, the resistance did vow that if the provocations do not stop by the end of this week, it will take an important decision by stopping or just throwing away any kind of cessation of a fire or ceasefire, mind you now. Last week, Isaac Herzog was elected as the new president of the Zionist entity, and it seems that a new government is on the verge of being formed in the Israeli entity. But is it wise for Netanyahu at this moment to get involved in another round of aggression, which he sees the best, maybe the best boat out of this chaos inside of the Israeli regime?
Yeah, so Netanyahu's regime, Netanyahu and his party specifically, the far-right coalition he attempted to assemble up and push the deal of the century, which failed, the provocations against Lebanon, the attacks on resistance factions in Syria and on the Hashd al-Shaabi in Iraq 2 years ago, those have backfired. So Netanyahu right now, in an attempt to shore up legitimacy, especially in the face of a multi-factional coalition of the Zionist entity that's attempting to kind of save face of the entity itself in face of, in light of Netanyahu's repeated failures. He's just trying to kind of salvage the little legitimacy that he is attempting to have. He has corruption charges, the collapse of his government and his coalition. So what this is essentially is that, like I said, he knows that he can't really stand a chance militarily or even politically at this point. But it's a sad attempt to save face, essentially.
Well, during all these developments, we did see an invitation by Cairo for 19 Palestinian factions from the Gaza Strip that took part in the last battle against Gaza. This meeting is supposed to happen in Cairo in the presence of the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. And as I told you, most of the factions are invited for the first time in such high-level talks. But some Fatah movement members were vocal about their rejection of such an invitation, meaning a wide-scope invitation allowing all the Palestinian factions in. Is there a chance that these talks might actually be fruitful, given that Abbas still refuses to acknowledge the very last election that happened when Hamas won the elections?
The whole context of the talks reflects the context of the Palestinian resistance and the force on the ground, essentially. So the Palestinian resistance is more united than ever. They have been more united in the face of struggle and in the face of the siege that has last occurred. And it is also clearer than ever that the PA, which is essentially the neocolonial force, containing Gaza, containing the West Bank at the direction of the occupation, which has collaborated against the Palestinian resistance and the Palestinian people to the benefit of the Zionist occupation, their legitimacy has completely collapsed. And they, just as Israel is more insecure than ever, so is the Palestinian Authority. As a neocolonial police force that is essentially losing its legitimacy and authority. So see, in the face of a Palestinian resistance that is essentially more unified than ever, it's just clear that these recent remarks and this bitterness by Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority reaffirms its lack of stance at all with the Palestinian resistance and with the Palestinian people. And this is something that's consistent.
Well, in the meantime, we had the commander of the southern region of the Israeli occupation forces, his name is Eleazar Toledano, announced that Israel is preparing to resume the fighting against Gaza, and they have in mind that this time they will not allow the security of the resistance to remain intact inside of the Gaza Strip. So we're talking about massacres here, a continuation of the incremental genocide by the Israeli entity against the people of Gaza. Sayyid Nasrallah was very clear. The Secretary General of Hezbollah said in his last appearance that there will be a regional war if the Zionist entity provokes the Palestinian people, whether it is in Gaza or in Al-Quds. But he was very clear, Al-Quds equals a regional war. Do you think that we are on a verge of the biggest war that this region has ever seen?
You know, I think that I'm positive that the Zionist entity's talks right now, you know, it wanting to be provocative, it's just empty talk, essentially, because it understands, and the resistance has made it clear, Yahya Sinwar of Hamas and Sayyid Nasrallah have made it very, very clear, along with other leaders of the resistance axis, that there is full support and coordination from all members of the resistance axis to the resistance factions in Gaza. And this will be furthered into a complete campaign to liberate Palestine and Al-Aqsa, should Israel fall completely through on its provocations and wage another attack of the same nature. We're to see that becoming more clear by the end of this week. But it is definitely clear that the Zionist entity, though they do not want to have any kind of provocations that's going to make them instantly lose, they still kind of want to save face. I mean, the entity begged for a ceasefire just because people, settlers, were tired of running to bunkers.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, it's just a balance that the Zionist entity is trying to have of saving face and trying to make itself look like it has any legitimacy left, which it doesn't, can ensure any protection of its illegal settlers, which it can't. And the resistance, which is on the verge of victory right now, we can envision victory as Lebanese, as Palestinians. And there is full preparation to achieve it and attain it if this Zionist entity makes any stupid moves.
Well, it's going to be a very decisive week indeed. Thank you very much, Julia Qasim from Beirut, political commentator, talking to us about the prospects of another ignition of fire between the Palestinians and the Israeli Zionist entity. Thank you very much for being with us. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about Yemen being part of the equation of Al-Quds.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, leader of the Ansarullah movement, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, announced that the Yemeni people are part of the deterrence equation established by regional resistance in linking the Israeli threat towards al-Quds to a regional war. Sayyid Houthi criticized the Saudi and the Emirati media and their shameful handling of the recent Israeli aggression on Gaza while praising the Iranian position. Sayyid Houthi also identified three steps to attain peace in Yemen by stopping the Saudi aggression, lifting the siege, and ending the occupation. More in this following report.
Leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Sayyid Abdul Malik Badruddin al-Houthi, stressed last week that the Yemenis are part of the Al-Quds formula, as announced by Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah, and will be present effectively in the battle against the Zionist entity. Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah consecrated, during his speech on the 21st anniversary of Resistance and Liberation Day, a new formula. If Israel tampers with Al-Quds, it will face a regional war. Sayyid Houthi indicated that Hezbollah and the Palestinian resistance were not supported by any Arab or Muslim state except Iran and Syria, highlighting the importance of the recent victory in Gaza. Leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement then urged Muslim countries to join forces against Israel in order to expel its regime from the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds and to completely boycott the Tel Aviv regime. The Yemeni leader noted that the pro-Israeli traitors accused the resistance forces of being Iran's proxy groups, adding that the Takfiri war launched against them only serves the U.S. and Israel. Meanwhile, Sayyid Houthi stressed that the peaceful solution in Yemen can be reached when the Saudi-led coalition halts its war and blockade on the Yemenis, adding that the Yemeni nation will not give up its right to freedom, independence, and dignity, and will not abandon its struggle against American and Israeli plots. Furthermore, in an indication of positive developments in the ongoing negotiations to stop the Saudi war in Yemen, an Omani delegation arrived in the Yemeni capital Sana'a on a visit, the first of its kind in years, on Saturday. The delegation was accompanied to Sana'a Airport by the spokesman of the Ansarullah Resistance Movement and the head of the Sana'a negotiating delegation, Muhammad Abdussalam, on a plane belonging to the Omani Royal Air Force. Upon his arrival at Sana'a Airport, Abdussalam said that the delegation of the Royal Office came to discuss the situation in Yemen on the basis of the principle of common interests. Abdussalam noted that the aim of the Omani delegation's visit was to work on advancing the humanitarian situation as well as the peace process.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Sana'a is Mr. Muhammad Ashami, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Muhammad. Now, Sayyid Abdulmalik Al-Houthi made it clear that Yemen will be part of the deterrence equation established by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah in linking the Israeli threat towards Al-Quds to a regional war. Are we going to see Yemeni ballistic missiles landing in the occupied territories of Palestine against the Zionist entity?
Israeli occupation forces take those warnings lightly from both Sayyid Nasrallah and Sayyid Al-Houthi, and I believe we may see defense operations and ballistic missiles, drone attacks as well, following the Zionist forces from Yemen. The remarks by both leaders reflect a higher improved level of coordination amongst the resistance access and affirms that Yemen today is a strong integral part of the of this new equation.
Well, Mr. Mohammed, Sayyid Abdulmalik went on to say that the Saudi and the Emirati media outlets took up a hostile position towards the Palestinian people, and especially the Palestinian resistance factions inside of Gaza who were bombing retaliatory rocket attacks against the Israeli entity, proving their allegiance to the Zionist regime, sadly. I'm talking about the media in the Persian Arab Gulf states. This strategy was surely part of the normalization process which these states have started with the Zionist entity last year. Do you think this strategy was enough maybe to subdue their citizens into accepting ties with this warmongering entity that committed massacres against the Palestinian people?
We all noticed that both Saudi and the Emirati exerted a very high level of media effort trying to spread their propaganda against Iran and the Palestinian resistance, while covering up also at the same time for the war crimes committed by the Israeli occupation. This in itself can be taken as an indication that there are many people inside Saudi and the UAE who do not probably buy into this narration, Zionist Arab version of the narration, especially following the resistance latest victory in Gaza, and the increasing awareness that Iran has been actually at the heart of Palestine, supporting and assisting its resistance. So no, I don't think that people are buying that narration.
Well, something very important happened on Saturday is the landing of Omani plane, on board of which is Omani committee alongside the spokesperson of the Ansarullah movement, which breaks way for serious negotiations and dialogue to end the Saudi war on Yemen. What are your views on this?
The Omani delegation that has just arrived with the head of the national delegation, Mohammed Abdel Salam, they arrived a couple of days back, and they said that they are continuing the discussions they had started in Muscat. Mohammed Abdel Salam did not comment much about it, but he implied in his brief comments that they will be discussing first the humanitarian issues, and hopefully if the coalition is serious about it this time, then this may lead to opening other discussions leading to complete ceasefire and bringing back peace to Yemen. We hope that they are serious about it this time.
Sayyid Abdulmalik Al-Houthi did identify three very important steps for peace in Yemen, which includes stopping the Saudi aggression, lifting the blockade and the siege of the Yemeni population, and ending the occupation. He means the Saudi and the Emirati occupation of Yemeni land. Mohammed bin Salman has turned several opportunities down that would have made this halting of an aggression at least somewhat easier than bringing it to this level right now. What is Mohammed bin Salman really counting on that would secure him a political gain, which for the past 6 years he had never been able to attain on the field, in the battlefield of Yemen?
Well, let's agree on one thing first. Saudi has lost its military war in Yemen. On the other hand, Yemen counterattacks are becoming more severe, more frequent, and more painful. So what are the options for Saudi? Causing maximum humanitarian damage to 30 million people, and that's what they are trying to do. They use that to negotiate military terms. For example, they say, okay, we will release you some of the fuel vessels, provided you stop advancing towards Marib, which is ridiculous. Sayyid Abdulmalik met the UN representative, Mr. Martin Griffith, last Sunday, and he warned him against continuing to exploit the humanitarian issues of the people, and he affirmed that this will not get them any gains, political gains. And he said that if they continue this, it only means that they are not serious about bringing back peace to Yemen or ending their war.
Well, in the meantime, the Yemeni armed forces are making great advances in the northern governorate of Ma'rib, while also simultaneously achieving groundbreaking reconciliation with many Yemeni tribes in that governorate, which means that less fighting is ahead, which means more reconciliation is to be viewed in the future. How significant do you think the liberation of Ma'rib will be in changing the balance of power in this ongoing Saudi onslaught of Yemen?
It's very important. The liberation of Ma'rib can significantly alter the whole political terrain, and most probably will determine the subsequent outcomes for years to come. The governorate is oil-rich, and it has been used as a stronghold by the coalition for their military operations for the past 6-7 years. Losing it means losing a major source of finance. It also means that the forces that are there will be outcasted. There are several mix of mercenary groups that are fighting alongside the coalition, including Al-Qaeda. And if they are outcasted from Ma'rib, they will not have an alternative place to be in. If they go towards the south, they are not welcomed. And that will further complicate the problems that the coalition is already facing with its different factions there.
What would you think that a liberation of Ma'rib would actually complicate the dialogue, the peace process in Yemen?
No, actually it will foster it, I think, because they are trying to protect Ma'rib with every level of strength that they have. I think it will be a very good gain, because they will not have any more strong points to negotiate on.
Well, the very important issue in this negotiation that is to be taking place, if it is already taking place, is the humanitarian status inside of Yemen. As you mentioned before, there are more than 13 million civilians in Yemen on the verge of complete starvation. What do you think will be the biggest challenge for Ansarullah in the event of a ceasefire?
In the event of a ceasefire, there will be a challenge of inclusion. Let's say the goal would be to include all the political parties and resume the peace process again.
Mm-hmm.
It is that peace process, if you remember, before this military intervention by Saudi, that was going under UN supervision, and almost the previous, the ex UN representative Jamal bin Omar said Yemenis were about to reach a historical consensus, a peaceful agreement, when this military action started on March 2015. So if they stop their aggression, I think it would be less of a challenge to resume that peace process and include everybody, but in terms of level terms, not with domination coming from Saudi or the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mohammad Shami, political commentator, who joined us from Sana'a to talk about the prospects of talks, negotiations, and complete cessation of a war against Yemen, and also the inclusion of Yemen in the Al-Quds versus a regional war equation set up by the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Shami, and thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Stream.
In the limelight.
The Israeli regime has a history of attacking Palestinian arts and culture. In 2018, for example, the Israeli regime bombed the Said al-Mishal Culture Center. says Rowaida Amer, journalist, in an article titled, Why Did Israeli Regime Bomb Bookstores? Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Samir Mansour spent more than 20 years developing a haven for readers in Gaza City. An estimated 100,000 books could be found in his library. Located near three universities, it was a vital resource for large numbers of students. The haven was destroyed swiftly and brutally during the Zionist regime's latest major attack on Gaza. Today, a sign with a defined message has been placed outside the remains of Kohel building, where Mansour ran his library.